Hey, a good Sunday evening, everyone. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. And welcome back to another episode of Sith's Basement, here only on True Radio Network. It's the Sith hanging out with you tonight. And tonight, I've got a jam-packed show for you lined up. I've got a tribute to my dad. I've got numbers 50 to 26 of the top 90s films you have to see before you die. We have some Q&A for you, my take on John Bolton's upcoming book, and an update from Real Clear Politics, because they updated their map. A few things changed, so we're going to touch on that a bit and my thoughts about that. Now, I've stirred the pot so far with the countdowns and Q&As, as well as opinions, and they will trigger people tonight, but I am keeping it, you know, relatively calm tonight. So let's get this party started, shall we? First up, I need to say a few things about my dad. You know, I've always said that I've gotten a lot of lessons and love from both of my parents. You know, they were married for 41 years through a lot of ups and downs. My dad always taught me a few key things that count today. One is family takes care of family. No matter how together and solid things are or how fractured things may be. Secondly, if you make a mistake, no matter how small it might be, own up to it and don't make excuses for it. Don't blame other people for your actions either to that point. Just two awesome lessons from a man that honestly at times could speak, you know, very little and had few words to say, but when he said something, you had to listen, as either it was something funny or a lesson was involved in it. Dana, even though my dad's been dead for 9.5 years now, the pain and the memories never go away. You know, the pain of losing a parent never goes away. My dad will always be a part of who I am. It doesn't matter in what way, shape, or form, he's always going to be a part of things. It was through him that I developed my voting philosophy of don't vote for the party, vote for the candidate that represents what you see as important and go from there. Also, don't vote down ballot. If you have to break down ballot, vote for another party, you do that. It's from him that I learned that you have to keep your circle tight and always be there for people, whether it's in person or at a distance. He taught me to stand up for my beliefs and for myself, but not to take it into overdrive. Respect other views, but if they disagree with you, don't degrade them because of a disagreement. Try to responsibly talk to them on a rational level and try to see if you can get to some type of common ground. In closing, I like to say, I love you, Pop. Thanks for everything that you taught me, as well as my sister, as well as our friends. Your lessons will always be a part of who we are, as well as the way that you helped raise us and you loved us. Continue to rest in paradise, and eventually when it's my time, I'll see you at the great Jubilee in the heavens. I love you, Dad. Okay, without further ado, it's time for part three of the countdown. Let's get it. Okay, coming in at number 50, we're halfway home, is Scream, the film that put meta horror into the mainstream, per se, from 1996. Now, as I've mentioned in previous episodes of the show, Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Loves, the first three Child's Play films, and Wes Craven's New Nightmare, they all had meta overtones in those films, but Scream was the film that had horror, had a meta concept, and made it accessibly mainstream, and everyone said, okay, it's acceptable now. 1 year after Sidney Prescott's mom was murdered, a killer starts killing high school teenagers in a small town wearing a ghost face mask. This is a lot like a callback, if you will, to like the 80s slasher genre. It really is. But you also have some really well-placed humor as well. I enjoyed this film on opening night, and I still do to this day, but it's just not as nostalgic as the films ranked above, that's all. If you like Wes Craven's work, you'll love this movie. If you like 80s slashers, you'll love this movie, because it has fun poking fun at that genre, and it's pretty cool to see Wes Craven allowing the genre that he helped build in the 80s have poked at. So, number 50. Scream. Coming in at number 59, Child's Play 3. Or as I jokingly call it, Chucky and Andy go to military school. Okay. Now, yeah, this film is a step forward in the timeline shift of the franchise. But you have to take in mind, though, when Don Mancini was approached during the pre-production of Child's Play 2, he was told by Universal that they were greenlighting Child's Play 3. So basically, Don Mancini had to take the first idea he could think of, and voila, there you go, Chucky and Andy going to military school. It's 8 years later after the events of Child's Play, as well as Child's Play 2, and Andy's been in and out of foster homes. He goes to this military school. The good guy dolls are being brought back onto the market after the controversies of 1 and 2 have died down, the events of 1 and 2 have died down. And Chucky mails himself to this military school. All hell breaks loose after that. It's a fun watch. It's got a lot of funny humor in it. It's got some really bizarre scenes, including a war game scene where Chucky actually comes in and replaces in the arms room live ammo. He puts in live ammo in place of paintballs. Okay? So a paintball war game turns into live ammo. Awesome stuff. But Child's Play 3, number 49. Coming in at number 48 is Encino Man, starring Brendan Fraser. Ooh, yeah. Pauly Shore, you know, one of the annoying people from TV back in the day, and Sean Astin. Okay, now, back in the early to mid-90s, Pauly Shore was a popular figure on MTV, so it got to the point where film execs were like, hey, let's put him in some movies and put his character on MTV that's so popular with the teens, put into films. Okay, in this one, Frozen Caveman found in the backyard of a social outcast high school student. When Dave and Stoney thaw him out, they use Linkovich as a key to becoming popular. Now, this film came out in May of 92. It was a mild hit. It was one of those films that, you know, Disney put out, that Touchstone put out, and it was a mild hit for the summer of 92. Could it be presented today? Absolutely not. It's politically incorrect with some of the overtones, but it's good watch, though, if you can go over Pauly Shore's annoying voice. Now, my producer, Katara, here. Katara, happy Father's Day to your dad. Hope all is well down there.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Hope you're having a great day. You missed a tribute to my dad. We're into the countdown. And at number 47, I'm digging up Kit and Play here. Class act from 92. Now, for people who don't know, after the first two House Party films, which were pretty decent in my view, Kid and Play go for a slightly more mainstream teen fare with this one. Okay? When I mix up between High School Records, picture-wise, makes it delinquent and valedictorian, Change Places, it comes with crazy results and hysterical results as well. Blade Brown, the delinquent, starts to learn that, honestly, you can change your life for the better, and Duncan Pender, he's learned to can't stand up for what's right as well as yourself. All in all, I enjoy this movie, and it doesn't get the credit it deserves, but I'm giving it props now because of the fact that it is a decent movie. You know, it's not as critically acclaimed as Batman Returns was that summer. Big deal. Still a good movie. Coming in at number 46, we have the aforementioned House Party from 1990. Now, I know Katara loves interesting trivia, so I'm going to break some out here right now. Do you think Kid and Play were suited for the original roles? Yes or no, Katara?
Were they suited for the original? They should have been, because that they own that
role.
Nope,
they weren't. No. Time for me to do some teaching here, folks. Yes, they were definitely suited for this film. But originally, this was supposed to be a vehicle for DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And here's why. Because remember the song Nightmare on My Street from like 88? Where you had, they were rapping about watching Freddy Krueger films and you had Freddy Krueger's voice in the background. Well, New Line, when they bought the character rights to Freddy Krueger, to the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, they made it to the point where if you used the likeness of Freddy, you had to pay for it. And Jeff and Will didn't know that. So they worked out a contract with them, and they said, okay, we'll do a deal with you. You have to appear in a New Line film as a part of the settlement. Okay. Here's the deal. Reginald Hudlin didn't want them casted in the roles of Christopher Harris, Peter Martin, so it went to Kid and Play. The story's pretty simple. When Peter decides to have a party, when his parents are out of town, nothing can prepare his best friend, Christopher, or their bud, Biel, on what's going to take place. If you've seen Risky Business, this is like an updated Risky Business, if you will. It's really fun, a ton of nostalgia, and it's like what Katara said. Hello. Kid and Play were meant for this movie deep down, so Hudlin made the right move. Now we're getting into crime drama here because coming in at number 45 is Sleepers from 96. Now, I'm going to explain how this could be a true story, but people just need to be patient, okay? This was the film that's based on the Lorenzo Cocatera novel, the same name, about himself and three of his childhood friends who were sent to a boys' home after a prank that nearly kills a man and destroys the life of a hot dog vendor. They get sexually abused by some of the guards at the boys' home and as adults get a chance at revenge. Now, I saw this film on the road when I was working in the restaurant biz, and I get the disclaimer that there weren't court records, etc. But here's the catch. I know I love the show Law & Order. Remember the tagline, folks, ripped from the headlines? What they do is they take the events, they take the places and the names, and they change everything. That's likely what happened here. The story is likely true. They just changed everything around, made the characters different, so that way people could be kept anonymous, if you will, what took place. And voila, what do you know? From the headlines, that's how Law and Order does it. That's how this book, that's how this movie was done. 45, Sleepers. Going back into the Star Trek file, number 44, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. This was the last theatrical film involving the original cast as a whole of Star Trek. As I alluded to, where it came to Generations, there you had Scotty, Chekhov, and Kirk. Kirk in a main role, Scotty and Chekhov basically is, you know, walk-on cameos, basically, with a couple of lines. Think of the ending of the Cold War, but set to a Star Trek theme, as you've got a Klingon Star Praxis that explodes, threatens all Klingon life. Spock, along with Klingon Chancellor Gorkon, they try to mediate peace between the Federation and the Klingon Empire. We have forces in both areas trying to put a stop to it, which involves framing Kirk and McCoy for the murder of the Klingon Chancellor. Now, no one expected this film to come out at all. No one expected a Star Trek VI after the failure of Star Trek V. It's a decent watch. It's a really good send-off for the original cast. And here's a plot device. If you watch Next Gen, I saw every episode, and you saw Unifications 1 and 2, which came out a month prior to the release, you knew of a major plot point to this film. Coming in at number 43 is a film that came out the weekend after Star Trek VI, Hook. Yeah, Spielberg makes an appearance here. This is the adult Peter Pan film, where he's now a lawyer by the name of Peter Banning. Peter has no memories of his childhood, and he's a workaholic lawyer with no time for the kids. Okay, this film is actually pretty decent, although Spielberg has said, I could have done better. Yeah, he could have done better, but it's still a good movie. And it does have a bit of nostalgia, because the holiday season of 91, we had some really good films. But you've got the late, great Robin Williams as Peter Banning / Peter Pan. You've got Dustin Hoffman as Captain Hook. Julia Roberts as Tinkerbell. And it's just a very pleasant film. If you enjoyed Peter Pan, you'll like this retelling more than likely. Far from a film that I'll pull out first to watch, but one that I'll watch from time to time. We get into kind of a B-movie deal with studio interference, because number 42 is Cool World from 92. Okay, 92 should be known as, we're the studio, we're going to tell you how to run your movie, because of what happened with Alien 3. Bashy. For those who don't know, he's the guy who created Fritz the Cat, the X-rated cartoon that, you know, to say the least, controversial. He originally envisioned this as an animated horror film, but Paramount demanded a comedy of sorts. So he kind of leveled with them and said, okay, but I want some action sci-fi elements in it. And it just turned into an absolute craziness, but I thought it was good. When Jack Deebs is released from prison, he ends up being transported into the world that he created via a series of comic books / graphic novels. One of his creations, Hollywood, what as in if I would, you could, wants to enter the real world, but that would cause a major disaster. And you have the subplot of Brad Pitt playing a former army officer from World War II, who is brought into the cool world after a motorcycle accident, and he runs the police department. All in all, it's a bizarre film. You don't want to, you know, the big mistake is that it was PG-13 and parents took their kids to see it thinking, oh, it's a cartoon. No, this ain't for kids. This is like teen and above stuff, but it's good. 42, Cool World. I can hear Katara sighing and laughing inside because number 41 is Demolition Man. Sly Stallone, Wesley Snipes. Yeah. Okay. This is where Simon Phoenix gets back to his old criminal ways in the year 2032. Because when he was sentenced to be frozen in 96, he had a sentence that expired all this time later. So it's up to John Spartan to stop him from being thought of as frozen as well. I know a lot of people don't like this movie, but it's cheesy fun. Okay? This is like watching Jason Goes to Hell. In this case, if you don't mind sci-fi action with amped up violence so bad it's good, this is your movie. It's as cheesy as the B-movies that came out in this era of late 80s to mid-90s. And if you approach this film with this mindset, you can get some enjoyment out of it. But if you take that out of the equation, you're going to miss the point and hate the movie. Give it a watch. Demolition Man, number 41. Whew. Katara, you're going to hate me for this. Number 40 is The Bit Son, starring Macaulay Culkin.
What?
Yeah, we're going
that
there.
Movie.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Our parents saw the ads for this film and got triggered. Oh, my God. He was so innocent as Kevin McAllister. He was so innocent. Well, yeah. Okay. Well, here we go. When a boy moves in with his aunt and uncle, he befriends his cousin, who turns out to be somewhat of a psychopath. Okay. Now, as I said, this was a major turn for Macaulay Culkin, because for this film, he was in Home Alone, Home Alone 2, Uncle Buck. you know, John Hughes family-oriented films. This was a major departure. It flopped, but thanks to repeated cable viewings, it caught a video of following on VHS. People have rallied to its side, and it's a pretty decent movie. And it showed that, yeah, Culkin could break away from being the good kid. And that's a good thing. Coming at number 39, I know people know I don't like much of Meryl Streep, but it's The River Wild, which has got Kevin Bacon, David Starthian, and Meryl Streep. When a rafting expert goes on a rafting trip with her son and estranged husband for her son's birthday, they're dealing with two armed killers on a river that is chaotic. This is a really hard turn for Streep. She does drama, but this is like an action drama. And unlike her role in The Deer Hunter, she wasn't involved in the Vietnam scenes in The Deer Hunter. And this is a solid watch. And this is directed by the guy who directed The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, LA Confidential, Wonder Boys, Curtis Hanson. And it's PG-13, rightfully so. I think if he added a couple of bad words into it, mainly a couple of F words and some, and a little bit more graphic violence, this film would have been rated R. It's underrated in some circles, but it's a decent watch, and I like it. The network knows my love for Dennis Leary, and he's coming back into the conversation, number 38, Suicide Kings, which also stars Henry Thomas, you know, Elliot from E.T., Christopher Walken, and John Patrick Flannery. Bunch of Queens prep school graduates, students decided to take a former mobster hostage for ransom to get a friend and sister free. All hell breaks loose because they can't do anything right at all. Katara, the network, all of you know, I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan, except for Hateful Eight. I hate that movie. In the mid to late 90s to early 2000s, it was cool to have plot twists in drama and suspense films because with Tarantino, he tends to have those twists that throw you a curve. And this film is no different, even though it wasn't directed or written by Tarantino. And the ending is a hook ending. And this film has a lot of funny one-liners. You have Dennis Leary, who's one of the underlings to Christopher Walken, being a former mobster, complaining about his wife complaining of a pair of alligator shoes. And it's just so funny. And also, when he realizes he's held hostage, he tells his lawyer, I think, if I remember correctly, just make sure your kids don't go to prep school in Queens. Funny shit. Coming at number 37 is Ed Wood. Yep, the great Tim Burton arrives in the countdown again, folks. In this film, Johnny Depp plays renowned and hated B-movie director Ed Wood, who was responsible for some of the worst movies ever made in the 50s that developed the cult following. And another reason to watch it, Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi. Knowing Katara's hint for irony, we have some irony for you, Katara. This film is one of two films that Tim Burton did not have the great Danny Elfman as composer. Can you name the other Burton film?
No, I can't.
Sweeney Todd, which was a great movie. it's like what I told the old man when I saw it. I said, well, they were able to show stuff that you can't see on stage. Okay, this is a bizarre movie that fits the legacy of Ed Wood big time. And honestly, watch it late at night. Watch it at like 10, 11, midnight. Because I caught it the first time in a midnight sneak and thought it was just awesome. And we're going to do a double shot of Tim Burton here at number 36, Mars Attacks from 96, which is based on the trading cards that were out in the 50s. Okay, I admit Tim Burton is very peculiar as a director, and his works can be very strange and bizarre. In this film, Martians attack Earth and have unconventional ways of communicating, and have deadly weapons and a deadly sense of humor as well. It's a sci-fi film. It doesn't take itself seriously at all. And at times, I like films like this. And you get Jack Nicholson as the president, who proclaims that at one point that two of the three branches of government are still functioning and two out of three ain't bad. Who does that sound like, Katara? All in all, it's a fun film that never gets old. And it developed a cult following like most of Burton's films, not Batman, develops a following after theatrical release. Controversial pick at number 35, folks, The Godfather Part 3. And here's where Paul from Charlotte smiles because he knows I love this movie and it had to be on here somewhere. This is the epilogue to The Godfather's 1 and 2. And it also puts The Godfather story, wraps it up in a nice little bow. Michael Corleone is trying to yet again do something he wasn't able to do in the first two films, make his family criminal enterprise legitimate. But yet the subplot involving the Vatican and their involvement, as we are learning about the ties between Corleone's business interests, along with the papal banking scandal, as well as the death of Pope John Paul I. It's a solid epilogue, but nowhere near as classic as the first two films. And y'all, miss me and Katara with the QAnon references to this film until things go into fruition? I'm not buying it. I was at mixed feelings when I saw this in 90 during Christmas break, but I've rallied to its side because of repeated viewings. Number 35, The Godfather Part 3. Time to push the hot button of controversy, Katara. Number 34 is Home Alone, the original. And I can hear the whining from parents in our generation that it's a holiday classic and should be in the top 10. But as Katara could tell you, as everyone could tell you, these rankings are all subjective. And I don't have a lot of nostalgia for this film as the film's ranked above. Okay? When Kevin McAllister is left behind by accident in suburban Chicago while his family is headed out to town for Christmas in Paris, it's up to him to defend the home when you have two bumbling burglars who try to rob his house. So why isn't this ranked higher? Okay. Honestly, it didn't need sequels to begin with, and sadly, Home Alone 2, you replaced New York instead of Chicago, shot for shot, same movie, same premise. And honestly, the films above this have more nostalgia, and also I really got tired of every Thanksgiving for several years. It's time for that Thanksgiving Please. Coming in at number 33, Kindergarten Cop. Yes, we're going with Schwarzenegger here. And this time he's playing an undercover cop who's trying to take down a suspected drug dealer who's been on his radar for years. He ends up going undercover in Oregon as a substitute kindergarten teacher so he can protect and try to bring in the dealer's ex-wife for testimony as well as protect the ex-wife and, you know, regular son. It's a fun film, decent change of pace for Schwarzenegger, because this time it's actually been had comedic elements, and it was needed, because we knew him for straight-up action, sci-fi, horror, drama, but rarely did we know that he had a comedic backbone. This kind of opens the door for that, and it opens the door for Jingle All the Way, Junior, etc. All in all, I really enjoy this film, and I like enjoying it. And when I do revisit it, I enjoy every frame. Time for that controversy button. Beep, 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 beep. Number 32, JFK, directed by Oliver Stone, 91. This is Jim Garrison, who filed charges against Clay Shaw and his alleged involvement in the assassination of JFK, which, if you read the Mourn Commission report, they said Oswald acted alone. This is one of Oliver Stone's best films overall, and it beats earlier effort in 91, The Doors, by a mile. And I'm a big Doors fan, so to say the least that I didn't like the Doors film that he did speaks volumes. And I know Guitar likes stats here about director's cuts. There's a director's cut on Blu-ray and DVD, which adds 18 minutes to the original 3-hour and 8-minute theatrical cuts. That would be 3 hours and 26 minutes. If you want the theatrical cut, you can get it on Vudu or other streaming sources. But if you don't like conspiracy theories or get tired of seeing the footage of assassination JFK, you might want to avoid this one, but it's a decent watch. Cult Movie Central, number 31, The Guardian from 1990. This is a horror suspense film that a lot of people have missed out on. When Phil and Kate Sterling move from Chicago to L.A. with a new job, they have 2 kids, including a baby boy named Jake, and they decide to hire a full-time live-in nanny. They catch us at Camilla. She's a part of the cult and wants to give up baby Jake to a spirit that lives in the trees. Now, look, people avoided this film, and honestly, it took me a while. It took me a good 8 to 10 years to get on board with this film. Because when I saw it initially in the theaters, I hated it. I'm like, oh, God, this is awful. I mean, it's the director of Exorcist. How can you do this? Saw it about 10 years later. I was like, okay, I kind of enjoy this. It's like a little, it's bad, but it's so good it's bad. It's so bad it's good type deal. So even though, William Friedkin wanted a better film based on the source material, it's cool, dude. I forgive you. It's a decent film. Number 31, The Guardian. Katara, you know I love the Coen brothers, right?
Yeah.
Just total insanity. You know I love them. And here's where you start to laugh, because Fargo just made the list. And compared to the shoe size, looks like it's a big guy. Yeah. Okay. This movie is funny as hell, if you like dark comedy like yours truly. When a car salesman hires 2 criminals to kidnap his wife, extort money from his father-in-law, his tracks are traced down by a pregnant police chief, Marge Gunderson, who's investigating homicides linked to the kidnapping scheme. Okay, before there was Quentin Tarantino with all these plot twists in the middle of films, you had the Coen brothers. Okay? And they're renowned in Hollywood for this stuff. Big time. Because you just don't know what you're going to get with these films. Saw this in the theater. I was laughing my ass off. Rented this on VHS. My dad, he was crying from laughing because he was like, this just doesn't make any sense, but it's funny. Kind of like The Big Lebowski, which will be in next week's countdown. But all in all, it's a film that it didn't need a TV show, but the TV show was decent. Part of it was on FX. But this film delivers. Coming in at number 29 is Bad Boys from 95. Yeah, I'm going there, folks. Lethal Weapon involving best friends who are damn good at their jobs as detectives. All right, in this one, Marcus Bennett, Mike Lowry, they have 72 hours to reclaim a consignment of heroin that was stolen from the evidence locker in their police precinct. Simple enough, right? Well, you see, they also have to protect the targeted witness as well to boot. Now, Katara knows I enjoyed Bad Boys 2, really enjoyed Bad Boys for Life, and this film is ranked this high definitely because of nostalgia. And for those wondering, next month we will be ranking a series of franchises, including Bad Boys along with it, that are action-related. It's a wild, fun, crazy ride. One of my favorite buddy films of the 90s. And this was the film that put Will Smith into the spotlight as a movie star. Okay? He had done 6 Degrees of Separation in the winter of 93, and that got him a little bit of recognition. But this is the film that turned Will Smith from TV star to major film star. And this is the film that transitioned Martin Lawrence from just doing comedy doing action films. So it's just seamless and just a lot of fun to watch. 29, Bad Boys. Coming in at number 28, Dangerous Minds from 95, which is based on the autobiography My Posse Don't Do Homework by Lillian Johnson. Now, she was a retired Marine who took up teaching at Claremont High School. Now, in this film, Ms. Johnson ends up teaching in a school where students are honestly left behind by the system racially and told, you're not going anywhere in life. We're going to put you through school. We're going to put you through the system, and you're either going to work at a dead-end job or you're going to be in prison. That type of kids she was working with. And she worked against the school system to try to change the lives of her students, mainly Latino and African Americans. It's a gripping drama, a lot of heartbreak, but he has some poignant parts in it as well. The ending is rather sentimental, but it's all good, though. A really solid film. Coming in at number 27 is The Great White Hype. The Great White Hype. Damon Wayne, Samuel L. Jackson, Jeff Goldblum, Peter Berg. In this film, after the last fight involving World Heavyweight Champion, James the Grim Reaper Roper flops financially, his manager brings in an amateur boxer turned hard rock heavy metal musician that beat Roper as an amateur to see if that would bring back revenue. It's a brutally funny take on the sport of boxing. The late, great Burt Sugar has a cameo in it as well. Failed at the box office, but thanks to HBO, Comedy Central, TBS, it really got a second life in home viewings. We're on the outside looking in of the top 25 at number 26. We're going with the blockbuster from 96, Twister. Helen Hunt, Bill Paxton star in this one. It revolves around two competitive groups of storm chasers going through Oklahoma in a day full of severe tornado outbreaks. We have the subplots of the rivalries between two groups of chasers and an estranged couple who's divorcing, sorting out their marital issues. It grabs you. It's a really great watch. Janda Bont was actually the director of photography for Die Hard. And he also was the director of Speed. So you're looking at the same director here. Okay, so Jamie Gertz was nominated for Golden Raspberry for Worst Supporting Actress. Who cares? It's still a good film. And there you have part three in the top 190 films you have to see before you die. Next week, we include the countdown with the top 25. Now, let's go into my Twitter inbox for Q&A. Sith, how do you feel about Kamala Harris for VP? Okay, let me get this straight. She attacked VP Biden on his work with segregationists back in the 70s and talked about being one of the kids that were being affected by busing, and now she's being vetted supposedly for VP. Here's the real reason why she and other African-American women would be better for that slot. America wasn't designed for black men to have socioeconomic footing equally as white men. This is why white liberals, as well as white Republicans, feel more comfortable with black women in head of the household roles in the black home. African-American people are not a threat to America with single-parent homes and a school-to-prison pipeline that gives corporations access to free labor. White liberals, as well as a lot of Republicans, know that black women in leadership is not a threat to combat white supremacy. This country still has a lot of white supremacy in it. Do not try to tell me any different. This is why Democrats are pushing Joe Biden to elect a person of color, namely a woman person of color, as a VP running mate. You have to wake up. Neither party wants to end the school-to-prison pipeline. It has nothing to do with unifying the country at all. Neither party wants this country unified at all. They want the same system to keep in place. Make no mistake, this is a play to try to get votes, but it's not going to be what you think at the end of the day, sadly. Seth, how do you feel about Joe Jorgensen? Ha ha! good one because you know what? She's the Libertarian candidate this year. I like Jo. She's really, really awesome. And I like her a hell of a lot more than I did Gary Johnson 4 years ago. It's hard to tell you. I hated Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson was an absolute jackass. And unlike Gary, she's very straightforward about her statements and her stances and also understands what's happening overseas and doesn't look spaced out when asked about questions on TV. Now, her platform is very much along the lines of what the Libertarian Party is about, which is a good thing. Now, I don't agree with her on a few things, such as the stimulus. She's against stimulus, but I'm for it. But overall, she's a viable candidate. Oh, and she called out Trump and Biden on their past treatment of women and also their past history of being racists. So that's a bonus in my book. If you're willing to call and put your record up and say, hey, this is how we're different, you get props from the Sith on that. We're going to trigger people. Katara, here we go. Sith, how dare you say the original Friday the 13th isn't the best in the franchise? Did I trigger somebody, Katara? Oh, no. What do I do? Okay, look. I'm not saying it's not a good movie, okay? However, as Sean S. Cunningham admitted, it's a Halloween clone. And, you know, Friday the 13th, I'll give it credit. It did set the stage for an inspiration for Halloween 2. You know, the one that takes place in the hospital the night after the events of Halloween, you know, right after the events of Halloween. Well, as that was more slasher, blood and guts, than the original Halloween. Look, I just haven't enjoyed the final chapter in Jason Loeb's Part 6. They're much better to me for a lot of reasons, but it's not like I hate the original. I just prefer Part 6 and Part 4 before it. I will absolutely watch Part 1 in a marathon and enjoy absolutely every minute, including the hook ending. But is it my favorite in the franchise? No. And note for you all, Friday the 13th is an oddity in horror, where the first film isn't ranked as best in the franchise for a lot of us horror fans, whereas other franchises, the first one's gold standard. There you go. This will make Katara smile. Someone asked me who made the better transition to acting, Ice Cube or Ice-T. That's a good one. Because as Katara knows, the network knows, love them both as rappers. Okay? Love them both. And they have both made excellent transitions into acting. Okay? Ice-T, he's been in Law & Order SVU now for 20 years, going on 20 years now. Ice Cube, he's been a major success in Hollywood with acting. Boys in the Hood was his debut. He did Higher Learning. He's got Cube Vision Productions. He did the Friday Trilogy, the Are We There Yet films, Barbershop Trilogy. I'm going with Cube, but it's very close. Both are as great as LL Cool J is with acting as well. And both Cube and Ice-T are on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. There you go. Seth, if you had a chance to alter a film or stop it completely, which would it be? Highlander 2, anyone? Katara knows I hate this movie. And even the DVD changes, you know, the Renegade cuts a lot like the producer's cut of Halloween 6, where it's a little bit better, but it doesn't make one of the worst movies of all time look that much better, okay? Look, I made a mistake seeing this movie opening night, seeing Sean Connery on the poster, knowing well that Ramirez was killed in Highlander. But the flaws go much deeper than that, though. The film is just so horrible overall that Highlander, The Final Dimension, via Highlander fans, is called Highlander 3, The Apology for Highlander 2. Okay? And none of the films that follow Highlander 2 considered a part of canon. I would go as far as to tell Sean Connery, no offense, Mr. Connery, to you or Mr. Lambert, but you were killed in the first film, you can't reel in canon, even though he is one of the greatest actors of all time. Just saying. So, Seth, did you see the DACA ruling? The kids are safe, aren't they? Oh, here we go again. Katara, what's our number one rule about politics? Always do your research, right? Isn't that what you mean, Nakia? The late great white GOP, Paul from Charlotte. We've told these people for 5 years now, do your research, right?
Right, right.
Jesus. You know, here's a good case in point here, okay? Look, you see, folks, it's up to DHS. When the Supreme Court puts out a ruling, it's important not only to read the news article, or if you're watching it on CNN or whatever, but also to read the opinions as well. Chief Justice Roberts triggered MAGA by saying that it's up to DHS to decide the fate of the Dreamers, but honestly, it was the right call. Okay, yes, DACA was instituted via executive order, and the challenge on that was kicked back down to the 5th District Court on a 4-4 tie from the Supreme Court after Scalia died. But at the end of the day, it evolved into a DHS issue, and the ball is in their court as to the fate of the Dreamers. This is far from over, but for God's sake, stop just reading a headline and do some research. It helps you understand things a lot better. It's something that we tell you here in the network, and we'll continue to do so. Do your research. I mean, Katara, when I find something in Nakia or Katara, like Dan, just research it, make sure, boom, I put it in there that I did some research. That carries a hell of a lot more weight, y'all. This is why when Roberts came out and called the individual mandate part of the ACA a tax, a lot of people ignored that part of it being a tax and thought the ACA is untouchable. Not the least, because a tax can be repealed via the Congress. So when they repealed the individual mandate, they repealed the tax. Same deal here. It's up to DHS to decide the fate of the Dreamers. End of story. And that'll happen eventually, I'm sure. How do I feel about the restart of the Trump rallies, as well as the dang video about his physical health that was in a troll ad? All right, movie reference here. Katara knows one of my favorite movies of all time is A Clockwork Orange. Matter of fact, she probably goes crazy whenever I post the Marina walk where Alex takes over. Stop cap. There's this part where Alex is undergoing treatment to cure him of his violent urges, and his eyes are stretched out wide open and liquor drops are being used. That's what it's like me watching a Trump rally or watching these dank memes. Look, I know a lot of Trump supporters love the Trump rallies. They have every right. I know that people in the Biden camp love the dank memes poking at Trump as much as the Trump camp loves the dank memes aimed at Biden. This is like reading Spy vs. Spy from old school Mad Magazine. And we're going to see this beyond the election, folks. Okay? With some people, it helps things with a sense of humor. Other people, it helps cope with their insecurities. Now, I'm not against the rallies as long as protections are in place and enforced. Just like I'm not against peaceful protests and gatherings as long as protections are in place in this age of COVID. There's no reason for blocking of entrances. Let the people through if they have the pass to do so. As far as last night goes, keep harping. I laughed about the crowd size at first, but over 10 million people watched it live online, and millions of others watched it on live TV as well. So the crowd size, although it was disappointing big time, he still got big reviews online and on TV. And as Michael Moore said a couple of days ago, people were lined up 5 days beforehand. Do not underestimate Trump. This is a two-part question here, because as people know, I'm a big Beatles fan who had the best breakup, and then my top 10 favorite Bowie songs. George Harrison for the song Give Me Love, Give Me Peace. As much as I love Paul McCartney's solo, as much as I love John Lennon's solo, Ringo, that one song is a song I listen to every day. Give Me Love, Give Me Peace, George Harrison. It just reminds me of so much. It reminds me of my parents, reminds me of a lot of people that I miss, that I love, that have died. Just awesome shit. David Bowie, 10 to 1. Black Star, which was actually on his last album, which was like a love letter to his fans because he was dying of liver cancer and he didn't know how much time he had left. So that's a really good one. Number 9, Cat People. Number 8, Scary Monsters, Super Creeps. 7, Heroes. We can be heroes just for one day. 6, Ashes to Ashes, which I call the sequel to Space Oddity. 5, Let's Dance. 4, We're Gonna Get Hate Mail, Guitara, Space Oddity. Sorry, folks, but the top 3 have just a bit more nostalgia for me than Space Oddity. Number 3, Starman, which when that got played, I cried my eyes out when he died. Number 2 is a deep cut when he was in Tin Machine, Under the God. And number 1, Blue Jean. Yeah. Last question, and it's a prediction one, so we're going to put this into the file for October the 1st. Will there be a shutdown or what I call the kick the can spending extensions? Or will there be a full fiscal year budget for 2021 approved? Okay, Katara, I've got a joke for you. We have oceanfront property in Phoenix to sell. If I'm going to tell people with a straight face that we have a budget, full budget, fiscal year 2021 on October the 1st, we have oceanfront property in Phoenix to sell people. Does that tell you something? I can't say it with a straight face because you know it's not going to happen. You know, look, I think there's going to be an extension on the current spending levels on October the 1st, as a shutdown would be a horrible idea going into a federal election cycle. Now, take in mind, certain programs won't be affected. If you're on Social Security, they will have already determined by October the 1st whether, and they have the money set aside already, if they decide to go along with an extension of COLA benefits for next year. So get in mind, folks. However, defense, DHS, and other departments, they really need the extension of money. And they would be in need of more funding immediately. Oh, and if a budget isn't ready by the deadline, 11:59 p.m. September 30th, and we get an extension or shutdown, put Congress, the President, Vice President, and also the budget negotiating team from the White House, $7.50 an hour, $7.50 an hour, minimum wage, without benefits until it gets resolved, and watch how quick shit gets done. They won't do it because they know that there's no way at all. Time for some controversy, Katara. Here we go. I got asked about the Bolton book a lot this week, about the upcoming book from John Bolton. Katara and Nakia know quite well. The late, great Jason Terrell, Black GOP knows, the entire network, all of you know. I hate John Bolton. Am I lying or not, Katara?
I'm not sure, but I'm just going to say that someone on Twitter leaked the PDF version, the free PDF version. So if you want it, come see me.
I'll talk to you after the show.
All right.
Because, you know, I don't like them, but if I can read it free, I'll gladly read it. Now, okay,
right,
look,
free is good.
I am not a fan of John Bolton. Everyone knows that. But you know what? He's the new James Comey. Okay, but where no one likes him, okay? Democrats as well as never Trumpers, they're pissed at John Bolton because the allegations are soon to come out in book form, and they wanted this as testimony for their impeachment probes. Okay, Republicans feel like shit because they went after their president, but deep down it's a catch-22 because they know he's a warmonger, never met an orgy he didn't like. So it's a very candid catch-22, and to the point he's in hot water right now in DOJ for not providing them with a manuscript to ensure that there weren't issues with national security. I'll be discussing that part first, then my reaction to all this nonsense. Or as Qatar would say, it's a hot mess, Dan. Don't mess with it. Well, we're going to. Okay, it's well known that if you've worked within an administration, presidential administration, if you plan on writing your memoirs, novel, whatever, on your time in service in the White House, there are certain protocols that have to be followed. A major key is that you have to submit all your manuscripts to the DOJ for review before it goes to a publisher for release. It's to make sure that issues of national security and other things that are related to that are not in your novel and therefore not at risk of being exposed. A lieutenant colonel who served as a military aide to President Clinton wrote a book about his time serving in the White House as one of the aides who carried the nuclear football. These are the codes that there are two copies of them, one for POTUS, one for the military aide in case an attack that is warranted went into an airstrike. Remember when we had the Syrian airstrikes early during the Trump administration? It's because the aides told them where the targets were. They acknowledged the codes back and forth. President gave people his codes. Done. Okay. That's how that works. Bolton, by all accounts, walked away during the process and decided to go forward not only to his publisher, but he's got an interview tonight at 9 on ABC with Martha Raddatz and with Brett Baer, I believe, Tuesday night at 6 on Fox News. Forgo the legal formalities and try to make a quick buck. But the DOJ's gotten cock-blocked because they're so up in arms about this book, it wasn't cleared through the legal channels, so John Bolton won't be able to make money off of this. He thought he could, but he can't. Okay? Because he's got a few things he needed to get off his chest. This is going to be a lot like, in wrestling terms, CM Punk coming back after interfering in a table match, airing his grievances and doing the infamous pipe bomb. Bolton's a part of the old guard. It doesn't matter if this book is true or false. The people that hate Trump are going to say it's 100% true. The people that are pragmatic are going to go, dude, you got character issues to begin with. But he's wanted a never-ending war with Iran, and that's why people love or hate the guy, depending on how they feel about war. I didn't like it when Trump hired him. I'm like, dude, what the hell are you thinking? And I sure as hell wasn't crying the day he was relieved of his duties. Now, this is a political shot across the bow to prevent Trump's reelection, and I don't think it's going to work. People that love Bush are going to eat this book alive and love it for every word that's printed. But a lot of people are angry about this, and it's a rare occurrence when a president seeking a second term doesn't get reelected. Ford screwed Ford, okay? He pardoned a lot of people connected to Watergate. Carter, because of the Iranian hostage crisis, people didn't think he was strong enough on it, so they got Reagan in. 41 lied. He went back on a promise, many taxes. We know what happened there. His family can blame Perot, but he made his grave politically going back on Reynolds, no new taxes. Trump, for better or for worse, he's been working on trying to get our military home from these wars. And the economy was doing okay until COVID-19. Now, the book won't change things. Although people like Bill Kristol will pray otherwise, but most of the media know. Now, one last thing before we get out of here, RCP changes. The tally is now 197 for VP Biden, 125 for Trump, 216 in the toss-ups. Now, despite all the hoopla from the crowds last night, whether it was the protesters blocking the entrance, AOC supporters jamming ticket requests, get the crowds down, COVID fears, etc., Oklahoma and Kansas have moved from leaning Trump to solid Trump. So they're locks for Trump right now. New Mexico has moved from toss-up to leaning Biden. That's the ticket. And I've already mentioned Kansas went from leaning along with Oklahoma to solid. It's going to be a bizarre race, but there are some problems that I'm going to visit here. With Biden's enthusiasm, most of his supporters aren't enthusiastic about a Biden candidacy, and they're voting out of fear of a second Trump term. And that's not good. Okay, in 2016, Clinton had the gap in total reverse that Biden does, and so did Trump. Okay, Trump's enthusiasm is around 63%. Biden's at 31%. The fear of Trump is 64%. The fear of a Biden administration is 33%. Fear bogs down enthusiasm, and when that happens, it doesn't bode well. Now, Virginia hasn't changed yet. It's still a toss-up. I'm still scratching my head about that. Oregon is still leaning, as well as Connecticut and New Jersey leaning Biden. But Trump's issue right now is South Carolina, Texas, Georgia, Florida, and North Carolina. Now, North Carolina and Florida are toss-up states, as they should be. The lack of pulling out of Texas is somewhat worrisome, but I think Trump will pull off Texas. But South Carolina and Georgia should not be leaning Trump. They should be solidly red, or at least likely Trump, not leaning or toss-up. As I said, Virginia, lack of polls. But right now for Trump, Georgia and South Carolina, those are major problems for Trump. And here's how I'm still rocked by the 41% approval rating for African Americans I mentioned a few weeks ago. That's well above what it was in 2016 when it was around 8-12%. And it's a major worry for Biden supporters, big time, and we've already gone through that. But here's what's going on. The Democrat Party's shifted hard left in some parts, putting Beto O'Rourke as the point man on guns. That wasn't exactly a wise thing to do for some people in the African-American community. Putting AOC in charge of the environment wasn't a smart thing either for African-Americans in the Rust Belt that depend on jobs that are going to be taken away because of a Green New Deal. What's happening in Seattle isn't helping matters either with the Chad people. And people are waking up that government is after your retirement, they're after your freedoms, and they want to continue the school-to-prison pipeline that our government allows corporations to profit from. And also it doesn't help that Biden was one of the main forces behind the crime bill of 94, which led to mass incarcerations of African-American men. So at this point, it's still a toss-up, but I could see 2016 happening all over again where Trump wins the Electoral College and not the popular vote. And let me tell you all something. This has nothing to do with voter ID, lack of mail-in voting, Russia, or other foreign actors trying to interfere. The selection's going to be the will of the people, and it's going to go back and forth between Biden and Trump because they share a lot of weaknesses. But if I were to do a slight betting odd right now, very slightly Trump, but on a dime, if things get catastrophically worse, there's going to be a blue wave so big on November 3rd that it's going to be something that's possible, but something catastrophic has to happen for that to happen. Right now, I'm making a prediction. The House goes Republican. They narrowly, Republicans keep the Senate. The White House is a toss-up. If it's Trump, it's going to be by the skin of his nose. Same thing with Biden as well. Skin of his nose. It's going to be close. And so that's a wrap for tonight, folks, here in the basement. Next week, we have Q&A, another rant, the finishing of the 90 films that you have to see before you die. And hopefully everyone has an enjoyable night. As we all know, that, hey, it's Father's Day, so we have a few more minutes. Spend time with your dad. Have a little fun. And again, to all the fathers out there, happy Father's Day. Take care. Love you. We'll see you next week. And a very happy tomorrow to you. Peace out, and we will see you next week.